It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. You know stuff's been going on with the site. He explains what's going on. Also talks about some pretty amazing stuff, including an experiment by hackers to show how you could get somebody's secure encryption keys by listening through the wall. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. Hi, everybody. It's time for our annual audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It helps us understand our audience better, know what you like and don't like, how you listen to the show. It also helps us tell advertisers what kind of people listen. But I promise you, your feedback is always kept personally anonymous. All you have to do is visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It'll just take a few minutes, and it'll help us make Twit even better. We really appreciate your support and any help you can give us. twit.tv/survey. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 547, recorded Tuesday, February 16th, 2016. GRC is down. Security Now is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Upgrade your brain for 2016. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30. And by Carbonite. Keep your business safe this year. Protect files on your computer or server with automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Try it free. You don't need a credit card at Carbonite.com today and use the offer code SecurityNow to get 2 free bonus months if you decide to buy. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/SecurityNow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we protect you and your loved ones online. Maybe not ourselves. With Stephen Gibson, the man at GRC.com. That's the website for the Gibson Research Corporation where you get SpinRight, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. Maybe not today. Well, hi, host Steve Marino.
Yo, Leo. Well, I had a different title for today's show this morning, actually. This morning, the title was Security Week Roundup or something. First, I was going to talk just about the elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman key stealing exploit, which will be revealed on March 3rd at an upcoming security conference, where through a wall separating a laptop that's just sitting idly and researchers on the other side of the wall, the secret key used for GPG encryption was lifted from the laptop wirelessly. But that's not really the top of the news. Then what happened was just this morning came news of a very worrisome, and it's so fresh off the wire, we'll be dealing with repercussions, I imagine, for a while. An 8-year-old deeply buried buffer overflow in DNS lookup in the GNU C library that is everywhere. I mean, basically, you take the Linux kernel and glibc, you put them together, and that's the Linux API.
Yeah.
So this is in IoT stuff. This is in desktops. It is everywhere. And it turns out that a specially crafted reply to a DNS request can take the machine over. So it's like, so then that was going to be the top of the news. Then GRC went down for the third time, I think, or four, depending on how you count. I've been fighting and losing, because that's what one does these days, a denial of service attack that The first one occurred around 3:30 Saturday afternoon. I was actually visiting an elderly sick neighbor of mine who's been dying of cancer for the last 8 or 9 years. Yeah. And he's so grumpy that he has no friends. And I'm the only one who will ever volunteer to, like, drive him around.
Good on you.
So I didn't know it, but we were attacked for the first time when I was over hanging out with him. I came back home and GRC was off the air.
I saw the tweets at the time and I wasn't sure what was going on. I figured, oh, Steve forgot to renew his certificate or something again, you know.
Oh, don't I wish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be a lot easier to fix.
So I drove over to the data center, which is about 50 minutes away. The light showing traffic coming in was, you know, on steady.
Solid.
Yeah. Solid. And I have some front end equipment, which like looks at traffic and filters it and deals with it in various ways. And coming out of that, it was just kind of like, it just sort of like really sad. And I thought, oh, that's not good. So I then did a packet capture. And in a very short, very span of just a short time, grabbed 50,000 UDP packets and quickly stopped the capture so it didn't overflow things. And then took a look at it. And it was all inbound DNS responses. So any listeners to this podcast know that we were victims of a DNS reflection attack. And this is something, this is not the latest attack. The NTP attacks are
time server attack. Yeah.
Right, the network time protocol. Those have been in vogue a little more recently. The reason, though, that those have sort of been sort of disappearing is that it's possible to reconfigure the NTP servers to avoid this that attack. Basically, bolt them down better. The problem with a DNS reflection attack is that there's really nothing that a DNS server can do. By its definition, a query packet comes in, and remember, the idea was with DNS, we want it to be very lightweight, low overhead. So it doesn't use TCP, where you have a three-way handshake to establish communications, to number your packet streams and all that. Instead, it's a very simple query response. And so for that, we use UDP, a much lighter weight protocol, where it's just a packet that bounces off of a server with a request to look up the IP address for a given domain. And so the server that receives it does the lookup and then sends the response back to the requester. Well, if you're able to spoof the source IP of that packet, if a bad guy anybody with an attack tool, and of course these are a dime a dozen now, you know, this the big problem with DDoS is that it's trivial to do. You know, it was sort of a novel thing when I was attacked back in 2001, about 15 years ago, was when Wicked, that script kitty, Michael, who I managed to track down and found him and broke into his chat room and said, hey, what's up? Why are you bothering me? It was novel. Well, of course, in years since then, the scale of these attacks have increased. And we talk about it from time to time. There are now serious third-party services like Cloudflare comes up often that specialize in protecting high-value sites like gambling sites that have to be up during the big game and other sites that they protect them from DDoS attacks. The problem is those services are, they're more expensive than GRC's total revenue by several factors. You know, we're not a big operation here. It's me and Sue and Greg. And so the future is uncertain, to put it frankly. So what happened was...
Man, is that effed up. I can't believe how just messed up that is. And by the way, this is kind of how you got into this whole security thing, right? Was a DDoS many years ago.
It definitely drove me way deeper into the technology. I had Shields up at the time, you know, and I was sort of doing internet security stuff. And 15 years ago, it was interesting. It was intriguing. It was like, oh, this is interesting. You know, I mean, I'd been talking about it and writing about it, and I'd heard of them, but I'd never been the victim of one. So it was interesting. But, you know, aside from the fact that, I mean, it's a, you know, no spin right will sell while GRC is down. So it zeros our revenue and frankly, potentially puts us out of business.
I feel a little responsible for this because, as you know, we have people who are trying to put us out of business as well. I don't know what I did to cause that, but I hope that's not the same kind of group of people. I bet it is.
I will never know. Yeah. There's no attribution behind this. People said, "Oh, what you know?" So what happened was Saturday.
Let's take a break. We're going to get going here.
We got a lot more news to talk about.
We got other stuff too. So we'll talk. but actually, kind of the anatomy of a DDoS attack would be very interesting. And you do know a lot about what's going on, despite the fact you don't know who's doing it. You can deduce quite a bit.
Yeah.
And we should say this is not a highly skilled thing to do. That's the sad thing. It's easy.
And your first comment was, are you sure you want to talk about it? And I have to say, I've kept a low profile about attacks because I recognize their defense is so expensive and it is virtually impossible to determine who's behind it without, you know, launching an FBI investigation. And I'm just a small fry compared to the attacks that are going on all the time. And I remember talking to the FBI about it years ago. But anyway, let's do this, the first sponsorship, and then we'll continue.
Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. What a world we live in. Our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. Now, these guys are also the good guys. These guys who do such great work to train people for a better job, to help people keep their better job. If you want to get into the IT, there is no better time right now to become a security expert, an IT expert, a networking expert. And, of course, there are multiple ways you can learn how to do this. And you all know that you can buy a book. They're expensive, but you can go to the bookstore and you'll see a ton of books online and in bookstores for this kind of stuff. And of course, if you want to spend money, there are excellent schools that will take thousands and thousands of your dollars to teach you these skills, or do it in an engaging and fun way at IT Pro TV. Tim and Don, who founded IT Pro, were IT educators for years. And they decided to do it. They decided it'd be really useful if there were something online, kind of like Twit, where you could tune in, watch classes being recorded live, participate in chat rooms, download content, thousands of hours now, with 50 hours added each week, on your Chromecast, on your Roku, on your PC, on your mobile device. You could learn, you know, you get your A-plus cert for desktop IT, your CCNA or your MCSA. You could study ethical hacking, the CEH cert, the AWS virtualization, security, crypto, and, of course, desktop and server support for OS X, Windows, and Linux. New courses include Cloud Plus and Active Directory in Azure, Cisco ASA Express Security with Todd Lamley. All of the videos have full transcripts, which lets you jump right to the part you're looking for. these 100 plus step-by-step virtual machine labs are so cool. You don't need to have a Windows server. You don't even need to have Windows. All you need is a HTML5 compatible processor, and you could actually set up, configure an entire network. And if you make a mistake, you just start over. The Transcender practice exams, worth $109. And all of this for one low flat rate, monthly or yearly, and a no-hassle cancellation policy, of course, because, you know, you get the job, you may not want to keep going. But I have to say, I think a lot of people do just to stay touched up in all this stuff. It really, and it's fun. These guys are great. They hire people not just because of their knowledge, but because of their presentation skills. And these people are so good at communicating. If you're studying with a book, if you're enrolled in a certification or technical degree program, it's a great supplement, much cheaper than a boot camp. They have corporate and group pricing available. Lots of universities like Harvard, MIT, UCSD, Stanford, all they use IT Pro. Check it out, itpro.tv/securitynow. Upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions, normally $57 a month or $570 for an entire year, but there's a special deal for your Security Now listeners. Try it free for 7 days. All you have to do is use the code SN30 to check out their courses. Let's see what they're doing. Yes, the Active Directory in Azure right now. That's on Channel 1, Channel 2 Cloud Plus. Kind of cool. And if you use SN30, you'll get 30% off the lifetime of your account. That makes it less than $40 a month. $399 for an entire year? What a deal! itpro.tv/securitynow. Use the code SN30 for 7 days free, and you'll save 30% for the rest of your life. itpro.tv/securitynow. All right, back we go. Steve Areno.
Okay, so the attack on the first attack was Saturday afternoon around 3:30 Pacific time, lasted about 90 minutes, and then stopped by itself for about half an hour, and then resumed for about 60 minutes, and then stopped for like 4 hours, and then started up again in the evening on Saturday. And it was going for maybe 15 minutes, and then it sort of changed, and I have never needed to get a hold of anyone at level 3, because GRC has never, in the time that I've been with level 3, suffered any denial of service attacks. And I got to know the guys at Vario, Andy Peterson and John Knowles, really well. Back in those days, 15 years ago. So I didn't know anyone at level 3. And this was a Saturday, you know, on Valentine's Day Eve. But level 3 was on the ball. They had monitored these. And the attack was substantial enough that it was beginning to interfere with the traffic of other customers with whom I share what's known as the aggregation router, the final router that my little subnetwork connects to. So they shut down the interface. They just completely took me down hard. I got them on the phone. They explained what was going on. And I told them, you know, what I knew about the attack. And so I've been working with them for the last couple days. And the attacks had been intermittent. We were able to get back up. I think it was Sunday morning of Valentine's Day around 10. I said, okay, I got him back on the phone. I said, let's try bringing it up. And we were okay. And I was hoping, because it was sort of intermittent, I thought, well, you know, maybe someone's just using me as a target to test a new tool. I mean, I haven't done anything to upset anyone, as far as I know. And so I figured, you know, because it wasn't like on and steady, but it was sort of coming and going, I thought, well, you know, maybe they're just, you know, I just came to mind. So I was hoping that that I'd dropped off of their mind. And we were okay all of yesterday. And then today at around 11:15, we got hit hard. And I got on the phone with level three. And I had tried to log into what my management portal, as they call it, that lets me see what's going on. And in fact, just now, while you were doing the sponsorship, I did log in, navigated through, and I can now, I'm looking at the chart now, and we had 12.875 gigabits incoming on the 14th, on Valentine's Day. So,
a second?
Yes. 12.875 billion bits per second.
So if you had Google Fiber, gigabit fiber, that's 1 gigabit. You're talking almost 13 times that.
Yes. And so this is why their only recourse is to just shut me down.
Right.
I mean, I want to be shut down.
When we buy server access, you might get it's common to get 100 megabits. And usually we get nowadays like you get a gigabit. But the cost for a 13 gigabit pipe to the internet that would only get used fractionally 99.99999% of the time is prohibitive. Right?
Right. And for example, I have 100 meg interconnect, as it's called, to the router upstream of us. And I buy 10. I have what's called CDR, a committed data rate of 10 megabits. So I pay for 10 megabits per month, or 10 megabits connectivity, essentially. And then it's billed on what's called the 95.5 rule. So, for example, I often see that we're spiking at 50 or 60 megabits while somebody downloads Security Now podcasts, because those are the biggest files that I host. But the idea is that, in general, my agreement with Vario is that I'll stay at or below 10 – not Vario, sorry, with level 3, that I'll stay at or below 10 megabits in like average usage. And if I am above that on a sustained basis, then I get charged for the overage. So that's fine. That I can afford. The economics works. GRC is up all the time. I've been with level three for at least 8 years, never had an outage. I couldn't be any happier with their service. And they've been wonderful to work with during the last 3 days, but there's not a lot we can do. I mean, this is a world-class 13 gigabit, flood, and it takes a class of service far beyond what we've ever needed in order to deal with that. So I've got email into the front office of level three, because they do offer mitigation services, but they're expensive. So I don't know how it's going to turn out. An hour or two ago, we had to just give up. We had to just unplug from the internet.
So mitigation services just give you a fatter pipe, essentially, on demand, right? I mean,
The idea is that we would here's the other problem that I didn't mention is we're not a normal website. You know, Shields Up and the DNS spoofability test and all these different things that I've built over time, that requires packet level. Operation. I'm sending out SYN packets in order to do TCP half opens to check people's ports. That you don't do that. No normal website does that. So it's also very likely that this stuff that GRC has been about is fundamentally incompatible with life behind a proxy. Basically, proxying these connections are what most websites do. Most websites just need HTTP and HTTPS. That provides them the web services they need. But that's That's not what GRC is. GRC has been all these other interesting, fun things that I've been able to do because I've just had a really good provider that gave me unfiltered access to the raw internet traffic. So in the, if it were necessary to hide behind some sort of upstream proxy, we couldn't offer any of these additional services, and I don't know that I can afford that. So anyway, I mean, this is all you're getting it in real time as it's happening, because I've been dealing with the guys at level three. They said, well, we'll see what we can do, but we can't do much for you because you have to buy this stuff that you need. And so and then they were closed on Washington's birthday yesterday. So I left voicemail and email. I got an email bounce back saying we're not here. Now I've had some correspondence this morning, but frankly, all of Tuesday is the podcast. So
I'm going to email John Graham Cumming, our friend at John Graham Cumming over at Cloudflare, and see if he would if there was something we could work out, maybe an ad trade or something to get you some Cloudflare. Because that's the best one. I mean,
the ideal solution is that this stop. I mean,
you don't know who's doing this. They haven't sent you a note saying, ha ha.
No idea.
So there could be it could have nothing to do with you. It could be, Brian Krebs gets this all the time because it's a bragging rights. Oh, see, we took down GRC. It could be because of your relationship with us. I shouldn't be so egocentric as to assume that's it. I hope it's not, but it could be. You just don't know.
Yeah, so I guess if there's a takeaway from this, there are a couple things. And one is that people should understand how vulnerable websites are to denial of service attacks. Should be a feather in no one's cap that they took GRC down. 100 megabits will take GRC down because we just have a simple connection to the internet, and it's that the economics of that works for us. So it's not like we're some super hardened, high tech security firm that's like hard to kill. We're not, The tools, this also requires no skill on the attacker side. It's a matter of using any Linux or, in some cases, Windows machine, because despite my attempt to get Microsoft not to put raw sockets in Windows, that's what this enables. Raw sockets is what this – you have to have raw sockets to do this. Microsoft went ahead and did that. So, and then the argument was, well, all Linux machines have raw sockets too. It's like, yeah, they do. And so any tool running on a Linux machine simply sprays DNS queries to publicly available DNS servers. And DNS servers, by definition, are publicly available. They're like web servers. They have to be on the internet in order to serve the people who are querying them for DNS, in the same way that web servers provide pages for people who are querying for those. So UDP packets, these little short DNS queries, are sent out with GRC's IP, 4.79.142.200. That's GRC.com. So you simply you deliberately rewrite this little this little IP packet with UDP protocol, saying that that's the source of the query, and you spray these to the world's DNS servers. They get them and they go, oh, for some reason GRC wants me to look up this IP address. Okay, and sends the response. And so the result is that all of the DNS servers that are part of this attack are flooding my one IP with their responses, for which I never asked, but we've seen incredible traffic aggregation, 13 gigabits worth of traffic that this attack peaked at on Valentine's Day on Sunday. And in fact, Level 3 quoted 10 when I talked to them this morning. That's the first time I had any sense for the scale of this attack because it's funny, I have had such a perfect experience with Level 3 that I hadn't logged into the portal for 5 years because everything was working perfectly. So I was unable over the weekend to log in because after 6 months, they just block it until you contact them. So I did that this morning. They gave me access to my own interface at Level 3. And that's when during that first sponsorship, I saw that I'm looking at this graph with some serious spikes of bandwidth. There is really no way to track this person down. It's like, oh, you know, go figure out who it is. It's nice to say that, but the reality is you can't. Now, I was thinking a little bit about the whole concern over cybersecurity and so forth. Well, remember that in order for this to be doable, wherever this person or people's networks are, they are allowing packets to egress from their network onto the internet with an obviously false source IP inside of any network, like inside of Cox. It's going to be, you know, 24.78.something.something, whatever Cox's range of IPs are. But if the bad guy or a machine under the bad guy's control were generating UDP packets, say with GRC as their source, it's impossible for that to be true as that packet leaves, just to use Cox again, leaves Cox's control, leaves that ISP's network. The router that is there on the boundary is seeing a packet leaving that says it originated from GRC.com, but it originated inside of Cox's network. So if the router was doing egress filtering, if it was, and it's also known as reverse path, if it looked at the packet and said, should this be coming from inside this network, and it obviously shouldn't, the packet should be dropped. And if networks were dropping spoofed packets with spoofed source IPs, this problem goes away. Now, the argument is, well, yeah, there are other ways to do DDoSes. You could, for example, swamp a person with page access queries, you know, valid requests for their homepage. And if they have a lot of scripting involved and it's expensive to generate pages, then that'll bring down their server. And that's the case. But something like the whole problem with spoof source IPs, I mean, we talked about this years ago. Again, I haven't wanted to poke a stick in anyone's eye because I recognize how completely vulnerable I am.
Well, and how infuriating it is that ISPs aren't doing their job.
You could argue that, yes.
There's no excuse for not doing that.
Right. There now, really isn't.
They could be, you know, in the Philippines. I mean, they could be places where the people don't care or don't know any better.
Ah, and there's a solution for that, too. Because, again, routers, for example, on the border between the U.S. and the Philippines, the routers know where GRC is. Routers have routing tables. And so they know geographically where networks are. And if packets are coming in from an interface that makes no sense, a router at the border of the U.S. could say, No, sorry. GRC is in over here. It's not out there on the other side of the ocean. And so, again, so we could even have international protection. I mean, this idea could work. But, you know, one of the themes of this podcast is inertia. Look at how difficult it was just to retire a hash. You know, the SHA-1 hash. No, please don't stop. We need it for an extra 6 months and back and forth and all this. So, you know, here we're talking about routers that are already overworked that, you know, and this might break some, this might subtly break some things. I mean, there's been lots of dialogue and conversation about this over the years because this is a well-known problem. It is completely fixable. Yet there is zero traction on it. And as a consequence, a simple tool this could be like for traffic of this size. I had no idea that we were dealing with a 13 gigabit per second flood.
It's amazing.
That's
isn't
more.
It? Wow.
Yeah. We've seen that one host could generate DNS queries. Because there is some size amplification. Depending upon the query you generate, the answer could be much larger than the query. And that's a so-called bandwidth amplification aspect where, like, say one host, one evil host on its own 50 meg connection, it's using all of its 50 megs to send out UDP queries of a certain size. And these are these can be very short, very small packets, but the response can be 50 times larger. I was going to say 100, but that's probably, but generally DNS responses are not that big, but they can be larger. So let's say it's just 10 to 1. So 50 megabit outbound bouncing off of DNS servers all over the place generates 500 megabits inbound to me, and I'm off the net. I mean, that's all she wrote. So
it could be even just one IP address sourcing all of this traffic.
Well, no. That's what, until I knew how big this attack was.
Yeah, if it were a gigabit, but.
Well, or if it were a gig, yes. But 13 gig, so that's a network of hosts, probably compromised bots that are installed in random, unwitting people's machines. And there's someone in control of this botnet. And, you know, and as somebody tweeted, remember, Steve, these are available for rent. You can do, you know, DDoS for hire now, too. So there's a business model behind. But and of course, we've also talked about the extortion. Many times prior to a big boxing match, the site will receive an email saying, pay us X amount of money by this date or you'll be down for the prize fight. And they elect not to, and sure enough, they're down. Now, those big sites then learn the lesson over time and move behind DDoS protection. This is not something I've looked into before because I've never had the problem before. We've been 8 years we've been like 15 years actually attack free until the last few days. I'm going to have to look into it with Level 3 and see what services they offer.
Buy it for a twit.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's part of the cost
of course,
business.
And then, of course, the question will be, you know, how will it affect what services GRC is able to offer?
Right.
Because, you know, we may just be reduced to being a simple website.
It's just, you know, it's like swatting. You don't want to talk about it if you've been swatted because you don't want to encourage other people to do it because it's trivially easy. All you have to be is an app.
Yeah. Well, and that's the problem. By no means do I want to present a challenge to the world's bot masters because it's easy to force me off the net. It's not like I have like some magic power. There is no such thing in this case. They're just, you know, this is pure,
well, that's an important point to make, by
traffic
the way.
Flood.
You have accomplished nothing impressive. whoever's doing this, you have accomplished nothing impressive.
Especially for me. I've got, you know, a 10 megabit
CDR. Steve's not trying to stop you.
CDR with level 3. Yeah. Talk about overkill. 13 gigs. Just use 100 megs. That's all
you're overdoing it, guys.
Yeah.
So
anyway, I no show notes, no podcasts available for me, no services available from GRC.
So sorry. Your personal internet works.
No. Well, yeah, because I have I'm with Cox and I've got a great connection with them.
Right.
But for example, I wasn't able to send email to you guys and Elaine, the show notes and things. I will be able to this afternoon. I'll reconfigure not to use GRC's SMTP server because it's unplugged right now. It's off the net along with everything else. So, I have no idea when, if or ever GRC will be back. We'll just have to, do what I can, but. You know, today is podcast day, and that's had my focus. I've explained to level 3 that I can't even get over to the data center to see, you know, to look at the traffic until after the podcast. So we will continue with the show.
Really amazing how how did this happen? How do we have people like this in the world who are just direly malicious? I mean, you provide 99% of GRC is a free service, and you know, very valuable to a lot of people. And
I think it's well, but you know, the internet provides people with anonymity, and this is only another form of the abuse of that anonymity. We see the abuse of that anonymity all the time on Twitter has been, you know, I've got a fabulous experience with Twitter. I love it. I've got great followers, and they provide great information. For me, Twitter is a win, but I know for many people, it's a nightmare. And and you look at the postings that are being made to so many blogs, which are again are just the conversations devolve quickly into nothing because of anonymity. And so, there's like zero cost to an attacker in attacking me.
Right.
And massive cost to me in being attacked. And I would argue massive to the degree that GRC is useful to the industry and to thousands of people. There's a cost to the community for forcing
that's
us off the
that's
net.
That's what's very sad about it. It's really sad. Okay.
So, we'll put that aside for the moment. We'll see what the future holds. I do not know at this point.
Yeah.
But you know, if anyone wants to say I give. I do. This is not something I can afford to fight or plan to fight or have the time to fight. So I hope I don't have to. There was a really interesting problem found, in a core library. Code was changed back in May of 2008. And this is in what's called glibc. Anybody who's done any work with the C language, which is the majority of programmers sort of before this recent change to, you know, PHP and Python and everything. I mean, C is what Unix was originally written in. C is what Windows was written in, it's the old school development language. It's what Mark Thompson and so many other developers, you know, choose to write in even today. The compiler itself just compiles the armature, the core of the language. It understands for loops and variable definitions and compiling complex arithmetic expressions and that kind of stuff. But anytime you use a function call, that's in a library. It's the C library. And that was the idea of the language itself being small was one of the brilliant ideas that Kernighan and Ritchie and there was one other guy in the beginning at AT&T had. And the idea was just create a small language, and then we use an external function library to give it teeth, to allow it to do things. And the beauty of that is it's extensible then. So what's happened is over time, this C library has grown. And so things like opening a file, allocating a memory buffer to do something with, or even the printf function, those are all in the C library. So this is part and parcel of any code which is of any C-based source code. They have the compiler and the C library. You can sometimes dynamically link to it, where your program stays small and it actually makes calls into the library, or it can be the library, the functions you use can actually be sort of copied into your code, so it's bound together. But either way, if it's in C, there's a C library. So part of the GNU project was to create a library for its use that was, you know, intellectual property, open source, and fit the license requirements that the project wanted, and so on. And for example, any Linux system has the C library as part of it. Now there are leaner libraries, which, because the C library over time has gotten very big and very powerful, many things, because memory's gotten so cheap, just drop the whole library in and don't worry about it. But there are, for example, in lightweight embedded devices that really need to keep themselves slimmed down, they may use a different library than glibc. But since May of 2008, so coming up on 8 years ago, introduced in version 2.9 of glibc was a mistake. And the mistake was that if the program needed to resolve, I'm looking at the irony of this because it's DNS, which the one look I had at our traffic on Saturday, it was a DNS reflection attack, as I first mentioned. But this is a mistake in DNS. If the program or the IoT device or the desktop machine or the server or whatever it is. I mean, that's how ubiquitous this is, and that's why this is a bit breathtaking, and that's just happened this morning. The news of this came. If that thing looks up a DNS address in sort of the default way is to ask for either an IP4 or an IPv6. In DNS parlance, there's an A record. The A stands for address. You're asking for the address, or an AAAA. And I always got a kick out of that because, you know, the IPv4 is a 32-bit address, so it's the original A record. Well, since IPv6 is 128 bits, that's 4 times 32. So they named it AAAA instead of, like, you know, A2 or AA or something to represent the fact that it's actually the equivalent of 4 A responses since it's an IPv6. So if the program, as most do, just says, look up this IP address and sends out both the A and the AAAA query, a subtle mistake in the way the buffers are managed allows the responder or a – oh, no, I have to say it, Leo. I loved when Renee said person in the middle. Just the
Well, you know, Renee, he's Canadian, very politically correct.
Oh,
yeah.
I loved it. You know, it's I thought, okay, we're being we're being gender neutral. It's not a man in the middle attack. For Renee, it's a person in the middle. So it's like, yes, we don't know whether you are a man or a woman, but we wish you weren't in the middle, no matter who you are and how you put your pants on. So the problem is that this is DNS. And remember that DNS is not in a there's no security wrapper for it. Unlike HTTP, where there is a security wrapper. If we use HTTPS, we have we have TLS to protect the protocol. There's no wrapper on DNS. DNS packets are just out there in the wind. So this is extremely simple to MITM or PITM, I guess, for Renee, person in the middle. And the reason is, if somebody were sniffing the traffic, all they have to do is respond before the actual response comes. That is, somebody who is in the middle is almost by definition nearer to the questioning device than the DNS server that packet is, then those queries are bound for. So what that means is that person who sees an outbound, the bad guy that sees the outbound DNS query, simply responds maliciously and can take over the device. I mean, this is, so you get a sense for how bad this potentially is. And so so the Google security folks did a blog posting this morning, and they said, and some of this is recap, but this is big enough. I want to share this. They said any Unix-like operating system needs a C library, the library which defines the system calls and any other basic facilities such as file or device open, malloc, printf, etc. The GNU C library is used as the C library in the GNU system and in GNU Linux systems, as well as many other systems that use Linux as the kernel. And of course, even more widely than that. And they wrote, the Linux kernel plus the GNU C library form the Linux API. All the versions of glib since 2.9 are affected. And so in their blog, they said, have you ever been deep in the mines of debugging and suddenly realized that you were staring at something far more interesting than you were expecting? You're not alone. Recently, a Google engineer noticed that their SSH client segfaulted. That's the equivalent of a blue screen. A segment fault is where an access is made outside of the valid range that has been allocated for a segment of memory. Segfaulted every time they tried to connect to a specific host. That engineer filed a ticket to investigate the behavior, and after an intense investigation, we discovered the issue lay in glibc and not in SSH as we were expecting. Thanks to this engineer's keen observation, we were able to determine that the issue could result in remote code execution. spooky music. We immediately began an in-depth analysis of the issue to determine whether it could be exploited and possible fixes. We saw this as a challenge and some other intense hackings. And after some intense hacking sessions, we were able to craft a full working exploit. So again, that means that the world is currently full of DNS DNS query functions everywhere, where if probably if the nature of the target were known, that is, you'd have to, the malicious guy would have to know what was making the query. But given that, responding with a special malicious packet or packets can give the attacker control. This is really bad. And it's, again, a perfect case in point of why appliances that are connected to the internet, this is, the appliances connected to the internet will have this in them, and they have to be maintained over time. For, here's something that has been in place unseen for 8 years. So it is by definition everywhere. Continuing with their posting, in the course of our investigation and to our surprise, we learned that the glibc maintainers had previously been alerted of the issue via their bug tracker in July of 2015, so last summer. We couldn't immediately tell whether the bug fix was underway. Oh, and by the way, the reason it was so critical, they took it out of their bug tracking. That is, the glibc guys did, because it's like, we can't even let this get known. So, says Google, we worked hard to make sure we understood the issue and then reached out to the glibc maintainers. To our delight, Florian Weimer and Carlos O'Donnell of Red Hat had also, and those are two of the maintainers of the glibc library, had also been studying the bug's impact, albeit completely independently. Due to the sensitive nature of the issue, the investigation, patch creation, and regression tests performed primarily by Florian and Carlos had continued off bug. This was an amazing coincidence, and thanks to their hard work and cooperation, we were able to translate both teams' knowledge into a comprehensive patch and regression test to protect glibc users. They say our initial investigation showed that the issue affected all the versions of glibc since 2.9. You should definitely update if you are on an older version, though. Okay, so what they're saying is that if you had something older than 8 years ago, there are so many other problems with that, that, don't stay where you are just because of this. Get the one that is newer, that fixes everything that's been fixed in the last 8 years, and this too. And then they say, if the vulnerability is detected, machine owners may wish to take steps to mitigate the risk. In their posting, they have a proof of concept detection. At this point, this is just a few hours old. So I've got a link in the show notes, which I'm not sure how I'll get them to you or to anyone. Well, I'm sure. Oh, in fact, if you just Google right now, if you Google glibc, the first hit that at least came up for me was this, because it was already tracking as something that is, very serious. So if you just Google glibc, you get the link to this, and I'm sure shortly there will be some safe proof of concept tests that a user could use. Hopefully, I mean, I wonder how that would work. You'd have to respond to a DNS query from your system. Maybe what could happen is that somebody could create a service. They could do a benign DNS server so that you do a DNS query to a benign test server, which will send back packets that will crash your computer. Actually, that's probably what it would do. It would crash your machine. But in doing that, you would definitely know the glibc that had been bound into your system, or your whatever, your Amazon Echo was vulnerable to this and could potentially in the future be taken over until this is patched. So they said the glibc DNS client-side resolver, which is what this is vulnerable to a stack-based buffer overflow. And the function is get address info, getaddr info. And for example, I use that in the Windows Winsock library all the time. That's the way you make a DNS query in, you know, in many API environments. So the get address info library function, software using this function, and I should say that which is anything anything that connects to the internet that isn't hard coded with an IP address will need to do a DNS lookup. And most things do, because you know IPs may change, and then and if you if you're if some device was hard coded, it would be stranded. So they say software using this function may be exploited with attacker-controlled domain names, attacker-controlled DNS servers, or through a, and they said man in the middle, we're not being gender specific here, so person in the middle attack. The getAdder function is used for DNS lookup due to a mismanagement of the receiving buffers. The replies from parallel A and AAAA queries may overwrite the receiving buffers. Now, these conversations, the glibc stuff, points to a patch at sourceware.org. So they've got a patch that fixes it. What they were able to verify was that at most 64K of data could be force-fed into the querying party, which is catastrophic. In a simple test, they were able to gain control of the instruction pointer in order to put it point it where they want to. So that means that you load your payload of up to 64K, and then point the instruction pointer not where their requesting device wants it to be, but into the attacking payload, and you're in control. So staggeringly worrisome. I don't see anything that mitigates this. Now, they say if you were to do things like have a firewall which would drop DNS packets greater than 512 bytes, you know, that would be good. It's not clear. Oh, yeah, I think it is clear that this requires a larger than 2K response. So the DNS response must be 2048 plus bytes. So, and that's an unusually large, although not impossibly large, but an unusually large DNS reply. So if you had something upstream that was blocking larger packets, that might break some valid queries, but it would definitely block the invalid ones. So, for example, maybe ISPs will consider, you know, blocking incoming UDP answers of a size now they said greater than 512. I don't know why they wouldn't block it greater than, you know, 2047. Who knows? Anyway, the industry is still responding or maybe getting ready to respond to this. I think we'll know more in coming weeks. But wow, you know, this is understandably the reason it floated to the top of the news for the week is it's the worst case scenario. It's a function core to internet connected devices in probably every internet connected device. Been there for the last 8 years. So that's all internet connected devices. We didn't have IoT 8 years ago. And it does require malicious traffic, but as these guys noted, not even a man in the middle. If you have a malicious DNS server, then an advertisement or JavaScript or a web page, anything that browser to do a lookup would fall through that library, cause your system to look up a DNS query. The response from the malicious DNS server would then crash in the best case, or in the worst case, take over your system. So, I mean, this is I can't think of anything. I mean, this is as bad as it gets, frankly, in a problem that is almost completely ubiquitous.
Yeah, that's the scary thing. I mean, every system has this on there. It's not – you wouldn't have a glibc on Windows or – you'd have it on a Mac. I should check my Mac because it's Unix-based. But I don't know if you'd have it on Windows.
Mac is FreeBSD, as I understand.
Yeah.
And I think there's a variation of glibc for FreeBSD.
Okay.
But there's been some evolution over time, so I don't know where they stand now. It may have been forked. There was a fork of glibc that happened at one point. I was just trying to absorb a lot of information this morning to put all this together, and we'll know much more in the coming days.
Yeah.
And I'll certainly have greatly expanded coverage of this probably next week. We'll know like way more. What I'm hoping is someone will jump on. It would be very simple. There is a proof of concept showing a packet that will crash a device. So it would be trivial for someone like a Kaminsky or somebody to bring up a test server that says, you know, do an NS, you open a DOS box and you or a command prompt and you do an NS lookup of this particular, you know, it would be, you know, I am a malicious DNS response.com, and if it crashes your system, you know you're vulnerable because a DNS response should not be able to do that. So hopefully we'll have a test before long.
You're right. According to Rourke's in our chat room, OS X uses libsystem, which is includes a free BSD version of libc. That the G in glibc is GNU, and of course free BSD is not a GNU product. So that would make sense. Let's take a little break. When we come back, speaking of Macs, error 53, Steve's take. I can't wait to hear it.
Well, and actually, it's some interesting, informed response from two of our listeners. So,
all right. But first, a word from Carbonite. When you hear about all these problems, you probably think, gosh, I hope I have a good backup. You don't. You're in trouble, especially if you're a business. Here comes tax time. What would you do if you didn't have all those records from the last year? Or what would you do if you didn't have your accounts receivable or your customer list or your supplier list? I mean, the businesses run on data, among other things, and losing that hard drive could be the end of the world. Oh, no, you got Jimmy in the mailroom backing it up. Oh, well, you're okay, sure. Jimmy does that all the time, huh? And where does he put it? See, this is why you need Carbonite. For home or for office, Carbonite's automatic. You don't have to think about it. It's doing it all the time. As long as you're online, it's continuous. It's also off-site, which is really important because no matter how good Jimmy in the mailroom is, if those backups are somewhere in the premises and the premises burns down, you're down. And, you know, look, I know it's not going to happen, but that's why you have insurance. Carbonite's insurance for your data. Whenever you're online, Carbonite's backing up your data over HTTPS. It's encrypted in place on the Carbonite cloud. Where your data's got its feet up, it's got its hands behind its head, it's relaxing in that beautiful climate-controlled facility. Always there! You can go on to any computer, log into your Carbonite account. There's your stuff. See? Looks happy too, doesn't it? You can use their free apps and get your stuff. You can even email a file. So it's also, you know, like cloud sharing. It's a great deal too. You pay one flat rate once a year and as much data as you want. You don't have to count it. You don't have to keep track of it. Try it. That's all I can say. It's free to try. Carbonite.com. Do use the offer code security now. Two reasons. For you, it means you're going to get 2 months free when you buy. And for Steve, it means that they'll know that you heard it on security now. And that will make everybody happy. Carbonite.com. Use the offer code security now, one word, to get 2 months free when you buy. If you buy. Try before you buy. That's what I always say. You got to back it up, though, to get it back. And if you got to do it, you got to do it right with Carbonite. Offer code security now. Okay, Steve Arino.
So a listener who is actually an Apple iDevice repair person responded to our discussion of Error 53 last week mm-hmm. and DM'd me. This is Dale Perkel, or Perkel. He said, Steve, I'm an InfoSec professional during the day, thus a podcast listener, and an independent Apple repair business at night. In South Africa, where I live, there's very little official Apple support, especially or except possibly from the mobile operators who charge huge amounts and generally repair time is on the order of 2 weeks. I offer an overnight service at an affordable price and hence have repaired hundreds of Apple devices in the past 2 years. Error 53 is extremely frustrating, as there are legitimate reasons to replace the Touch ID sensor, such as accidental or liquid damage or failure of the home button mechanism. I always advise my customer that this will void the warranty, if there is one, and Touch ID will be disabled, to which they consent. Why, when an update is then installed weeks or months later, should the iPhone be irrevocably bricked with no possibility of recovering data? If there were criminal or unauthorized access happening, surely the attacker wouldn't take the opportunity to upgrade to the latest iOS. The window of opportunity is essentially infinite for a determined attacker. Why can the iOS update not just detect the missing or changed fingerprint reader and destroy the contents of the secure enclave without turning the entire iPhone into a very expensive paperweight? I trust Apple to provide the best possible security, and they rarely fail. But this is akin to needing to buy a new car if you lose your car keys.
Somebody else said, thanks. if you lose your key to the door, the locksmith doesn't come and throw the door out. He fixes the lock.
Right. And he says, thanks for the great show. I look forward to it every week. Cheers, Dale. And I'll just add that, and I won't go through this, the second one actually was from a listener who gave me a link to a really neat woman who repairs iPhones, I guess as her business, because she's got a YouTube video talking about this problem with the Error 53, and it shows a stereo microscope and lots of equipment used for dealing with this, and she goes on at some length. I think it was 53-minute long video, so not worth sharing, but basically she explains something that I didn't quite understand, which was that, you know, the iPhone 5S, which first had the fingerprint reader, did not behave this way. The bricking is new with the iPhone 6. So this is one of the things that caught people off guard initially, was that you can have the screen change, you can change the button. Some people, like, just for vanity reasons, they want a black face with a white home button, or vice versa. You know, they want something special, or they need the button replaced. And so a third-party site does it and says, you know, this is going to – your Touch ID won't work anymore. And they go, oh, yeah, okay, fine. You know, better than not having – you know, I mean, not having the home button work at all. But then the 5 series phones didn't care. That stuff was deactivated, but the phone continued.
Yeah, 5 then didn't have Apple Pay, only the 5S.
Right.
I think it has to do with Apple Pay.
Okay, so what I understand is the 5S did not do this.
Oh, okay.
It was the 6.
It wasn't until the 6, all right.
Yes. Yeah, so anyway,
just lead me to think it's a bug as opposed to something Apple intended to do. Apple, of course, isn't being very...
And what has happened since? I've not kept
nothing.
In touch. I thought maybe... No kidding. So, wow.
I mean, Apple... I think Apple will do something. Apple never moves fast in this kind of thing.
And what's their official position on third-party service? Are they anti-third-party service?
Yeah, don't sell. You can't buy official Apple parts.
Interesting. So they're cloned parts?
I don't know.
They must be cloned. Cloned parts.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the story is with that. Am I wrong? But I believe. I'm asking the chat room. I believe that. You know, iFixit, Kyle Wiens at iFixit has had some stuff to say about this. You know, there's this right to repair movement where you should have the right to repair your own stuff. And, of course, iFixit makes the tools available, makes the parts available, makes the manuals available. But even Kyle says, you know, I don't think this was intentional on Apple's part. Because there's lots of ways you could handle this that wouldn't make the brick the phone, but would protect security.
But don't ever try to delaminate the screen of an iPhone. Jenny brought me her cracked faceplate.
Oh, no, you have to replace the whole thing. It's a unit.
And all she had, she said, here, Steve, could you, like, replace the screen? And so I started to, and then I saw the instructions that involve, you know, the blow dryer to heat the glue.
Yeah.
It's like,
Apple doesn't
my
want you going
Lord.
Inside.
Oh.
They even have proprietary machines in the back of the Apple store to do a lot of this stuff, to separate it and stuff. They've designed machines. Apple's never wanted, going back to the Macintosh where they used Torx screws because they were so rare to find a Torx head.
Right.
Steve never wanted you getting those things. So, and Apple's always had a kind of a mixed relationship with even Apple resellers. Essentially, they've put them all out of business. My friend Tom Santos, who ran Mac Adam in San Francisco, was always complaining because he could never match Apple's prices. Apple's always going to cost him more than it costs. So Apple's never really liked the third parties that much. I don't think they did this to the third parties. I don't think that's what it looks like, but I don't think that's what they did.
So if they continue the policy, then what this is a wake-up call event, and the new wisdom will be, well, if you really insist on using a third party to replace your button, absolutely never update your phone.
Yeah, or, but even that's going to – I mean, Apple does updates without asking all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you don't own your phone. When you buy an iPhone particularly, you don't own your phone. Some manufacturers – even on Android, some manufacturers are worse than others. But Samsung has a similar situation on their Galaxies. They have the Knox enclave. They have a fingerprint reader. If this happens on a Samsung phone, you could still use the phone. You just can't use Samsung Pay, you know.
Yeah.
But Apple's – but you know, there's such a brisk resale market for stolen iPhones that Apple, I think, is responding to that as well. That's why they have, a kill switch. You can't take an iPhone and reactivate it unless you know the original password and all these things. And I think this is part of that. I don't think the error 53 is intentional. I think that's
and for what it's worth, from a security
it's the right thing
design,
to do, right?
Yes, it is absolutely. We on this podcast would stand behind the concept that you mess with a fingerprint reader, then all bets are off.
Right.
So, yeah. Although, I agree with Dale that wiping the enclave, that is wiping the secure information store from, which was tied to the input device, to me, that's, if Apple wanted to allow people to do what you've explained they really don't want to allow people to do, they could. But again, I don't. As you've said, there's really no motivation on their part. They're not saying this is third party serviceable. So, take it to Apple if you want it fixed.
Yeah.
And we're sorry if there aren't any nearby with convenient hours, and if the backlog is 5 months. Wow. So, I did in the wake of our conversations about the whole get Windows 10 thing. I have two things. First, I want to update us on that ridiculous Cheez-Crust.
Now, you saw Edbot's takedown. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But in the wake of me mentioning last week that I had just set up a new Windows 7 machine and had used the sanctioned Microsoft update, which added the switches and in my experience, completely and beautifully solved the problem. Many people tweeted saying, where was that again? How do I find that? And so I felt it was so important that I, at the time, created a bit.ly link so that everyone would always be able to find it. So it is bit.ly/no-10. GWX.
This is the GWX and, control panel, right, that we've talked about.
No.
This is no, something
that's
else.
The yes, this is that. This is Microsoft's sanctioned means, and it's beautiful. So what I did was I set up a brand new Win 7 Ultimate, and then before installing any – and that was Service Pack 1, which is the latest and last Service Pack. I then added this one update that they provide, and there's one for Windows 7, and there's a different one for 8.1. And so when you do that, you get a couple new features that allow you to then formally disable all GWX from then on. And so I did that and then went patch happy. It was 144 patches the first round. And I did this, you know, the optional ones that made sense and so forth, and never had a problem. So again, bit.ly/NO-GWX, and that will redirect you to Windows page where you can find the official way of doing it. And you don't need the GWX control panel. You do. There is much more to it than that, unfortunately, because they don't really want you to do this. There's no, like, you know, the fix me button that we've talked about. They could easily have made this a fix me button where you just press it. And
it's
like,
just
okay,
a registry.
Good.
It's a registry script, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And in this case, it adds some features. It is a deeper change that adds features to the group policy system and the registry. But you still have to go in and then use gpedit and navigate down into the tree, find a new item that this patch adds to group policy to say, no, never do anything to do with get Windows 10, and it's effective. So bit.ly/NO-GWX, and write it down, and it works. Okay, so last week, and I have to apologize because I didn't give the story the focus I should have, as we all know that I missed a crucial line in Jesus Crust's posting where he said that he had turned off the three pages of privacy settings and this was all the traffic that was generated. But, you know, I was just intending to cover the story. I didn't go into it any deeper. Ed Bott at ZDNet did a beautiful takedown of Forbes, hair on fire. Oh my God, Windows 10 is even worse than you thought story. And there's been lots of retractions and backings and ways, and apparently Jesus Crust has disappeared and so forth.
He wisely pulled the site down.
Yes. Yeah. The number one issue was where, as Ed wrote, Mr. Crust reports, quote, he configured the DDWRT router to drop and log all connection attempts via IP tables through the DDWRT router that was being produced by Windows 10 Enterprise. Well, now anyone who's network aware is going, oh, well, of course it generated a lot of traffic because
it kept trying.
Yes. Yes. It wasn't that it was actually wanting to communicate that many connection attempts. It's that they were being blocked. So rather than succeeding with whatever little conversation it wanted to have with Microsoft or with the CDN provider that they were using, and then it would have said, okay, fine, it didn't understand why it wasn't able to communicate. And so it just kept doing so. So, you know, what we don't know, I mean, it would be nice to have a much more responsible reporter who understands the way Windows 10 Enterprise is going to work. Oh, and Ed also notes that it's not clear why he chose Windows 10, he meaning Mr. Crust, or we'll just call him Jesus, why he chose Windows 10 Enterprise. It's not an end user machine. But Ed notes that the Enterprise version has way more power that an enterprise would and I mean could and would use to quiet down all of this telemetry stuff, if that's what they wanted to do, down in the group policy stuff. So yeah, though there's those three little pages of, you know, friendly setup time stuff that you're able to turn off, but you can go far more deeply using group policy, which is what an enterprise would do if it wanted to turn things down. So anyway, it was bogus story.
The big one that had 1,339 hits was a Teredo server, which is an IPv6 to IPv4 conversion server. And of course, if you
it's
not giving anything up to Microsoft. This is normal. And if you if you say block it, it's going to keep trying.
I think they were UDP on port 137.
Yeah.
And
there was doing that BIOS stuff too. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway,
nothing to worry about.
Should have spent more time on the story. I apologize for that last week, but now we're up to speed and current. Our friend Bruce Schneier did something that I think is brilliant. In his most recent blog, and I have a link in the show notes, he did a worldwide encryption product survey. He provides it in several different forms, one as an Excel spreadsheet. But I love it because I can't think of anything that could better drive home to our otherwise rather clueless U.S. legislators that encryption is already out of the box. Encryption has escaped. Encryption is not something you can legislate against. I mean, they tried back in the make the keys only 40 bits for export on SSL back in the very first days. And then that decision, as we've talked about, is still hurting us because we had weakened security for so long. He wrote, "Today I released my worldwide survey of encryption products. The findings of this survey identified 619 entities that sell encryption products. Of those, 412, or about two-thirds, are outside the United States, calling into question the efficacy of any U.S. mandates forcing backdoors for law enforcement access. It also showed that anyone who wants to avoid U.S. surveillance has over 567 competing products to choose from. These foreign products offer a wide variety of secure applications, from voice encryption to text message encryption, file encryption, network traffic encryption, anonymous currency, you name it, providing the same levels of security as U.S. products do today." And then he pulled out some bullet points. He says, there are at least 865 hardware or software products incorporating encryption from 55 different countries. So you can even choose the country of origin. This includes 546 encryption products from outside the U.S., representing two-thirds of the total. The most common non-U.S. country for encryption products is Germany, with 112 products. This is followed by the UK, Canada, France, and Sweden in that order. The five most common countries for encryption products, including the US, account for two-thirds of the total. But smaller countries like Algeria, Argentina, Belize, the British Virgin Islands, Chile, Cyprus, Estonia, Iraq, Malaysia, St. Kitts and Nevis, whatever that is. Nevis?
Yeah,
is that where you've gone?
Nevis. Caribbean.
Oh, Nevis.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Of course it is. Sounds beautiful. Tanzania and Thailand.
Yeah.
Tanzania.
Yeah.
I practiced pronouncing that before the show and then forgot.
I know. It's hard to get the syllables right on that. Yeah.
And Thailand each produce at least one encryption product. All of those crazy, like Estonia. Well, not Estonia is actually a techno leader.
No, in fact, that's the one you're going to have to worry about because they love this stuff. They're very literate. And very smart.
Yeah. And they see, and he says, of the 546 foreign encryption products we found, 56% are available for sale and 44% are free. 66% are proprietary and 34% are open source. Hmm. Some for sale products also have a free version. Of at least 587 entities, primarily companies, either sell or give away encryption products. Of those, 374, or about two-thirds, are outside the U.S. And finally, of the 546 foreign encryption products, 47 are file encryption, 86 are email encryption, 104 are message encryption, 35 are voice encryption, and 61 are virtual private networking products. So I thought this was great. Hopefully this will turn up in some congressional testimony where this serves to demonstrate that third party solutions are available and those will get used by anyone who wants them anywhere in the world. That they're just unfortunately, encryption is math, and it is free, and it is available.
Yep.
So my favorite person. Oh, and I forgot to put a photo in the show notes because it gives me the willies every time I look at his face. If you can click the link in the show notes.
My computer is crashed, so I can't.
Ah, okay.
Oh, just have to imagine it.
Okay, fine.
It's a gray screen of death.
Anyway, it's my favorite person, James Clapper, who really, really upset me. And we've talked about it on the podcast. Our listeners know when he just bold-facedly lied to the Senate when he said that this is back in the pre-Snowden. Remember, this was like 6 months before the Snowden revelations when he thought he could get away with lying and saying that we're not collecting any data on Americans.
No, of course not.
What he said. Not, and he's like scratching his head. And, John Stewart at the time said – showed it several times. And he says, this is what's known as a tell. anyway, so – he's at it again. The Guardian reports, and this is short. I'll share this. They wrote, the U.S. intelligence chief has acknowledged for the first time that agencies might use a new generation of smart household devices to increase their surveillance capabilities. Yes.
Shocking.
Yeah, I know. Shocking, but he actually said it is what's amazing. Yeah. As increasing numbers of devices connect to the internet and to one another, the so-called Internet of Things promises consumers increased convenience. The remotely operated thermostat from Google-owned Nest is a leading example. But as home computing migrates away from the laptop, the tablet, and the smartphone – experts warn, and we've been doing that here, that the security features on the coming wave of automobiles, dishwashers, and alarm systems lag far behind. In an appearance at a Washington think tank last month, the director of the National Security Agency, now that's a different guy, that's our friend Admiral Mike Rogers, and he's also no friend of privacy, said that it was time to consider making the home devices more defensible, whatever that means, but did not address the opportunities that increased numbers and even categories of connected devices provide to his surveillance agency. However, James Clapper, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, I can't believe he still has his job, was more direct in testimony submitted to the Senate on Tuesday as part of an assessment of threats facing the United States. Clapper said, quote, "In the future, intelligence services might use the Internet of Things for identification, surveillance, monitoring, location tracking, and targeting, for recruitment, or to gain access to networks or user credentials." So, yes, our friend is still at it. And I know that our listeners are interested in sequestering their IoT stuff on its own network where it can't get to the rest of their network. And boy, you know, with something like this glibc vulnerability, which is, I mean, a perfect example of why this is important, because all that has to happen is some IoT device is identified that has glibc in it, and anyone sniffing traffic of that device going out to resolve the IP of its mothership responds with a malicious packet, and they're in and on your network. Oh. A fun little non-security and also non-shivering tidbit just popped up. This will be a presentation given tomorrow, Wednesday. That would be the 17th at tomorrow's Society for Optical Engineering Conference in San Francisco, reporting on a group that have developed what they call 5D data storage by ultra-fast laser writing in glass. Yes, folks, we are approaching the glass cube storage technology that we've been talking about and wanting for about 10 years. The story that covered this says, wrote that scientists at the University of Southampton have made a major step forward in the development of digital data storage that's capable of surviving, and here it is, for billions of years, using what they call nanostructured glass. Scientists from the university's Optoelectronics Research Center have developed the recording and retrieval process of, again, they call it five-dimensional, I'll explain why in a second, digital data by femtosecond laser writing. Femtosecond, that's very fast. The storage allows unprecedented properties, including 360 terabytes per disk data capacity. And if we're talking about the disk they showed in the article, it's like a 1-inch diameter disk. It was a tiny little thing. It's actually not glass. Well, it's quartz, and so it's you know, good glass. So what they're demonstrating is in this small disk, they can now. So we're getting sort of down to the near molecular level, 360 terabytes per little tiny disk, with thermal stability up to 1,000 degrees centigrade and virtually unlimited lifetime at room temperature, or if at 190 degrees C, it would only then last for 13.8 billion years. So
now you hit it with a hammer, it's another matter entirely.
Exactly. So, and of course, we also know that if the reader breaks, well, that's a problem.
Yeah, because at least the medium is okay. Yeah.
Yes, isn't that good. Cool? I mean, yeah. we've talked about long-term archiving.
Well, CDs and DVDs are not right.
Right.
No
right.
Magnetic material is, and CDs and DVDs corrupt over time.
Yep. Yep. So they said this opens a new era of eternal data archiving.
Now, you got to store it in a way that would be like an alien technology or a future generations could look at it and go, oh, that's probably ones and zeros. Let's, you know, maybe we can decode this. It'd have to have something kind of obvious, right?
Right.
Not a zip disk.
And so they're calling it a self-assembled nanostructure created in infused quartz. And the reason they use this 5D is that you have, first of all, the regular 3D of that we're familiar with, length, height, and width. So it's location in three space in this crystal. And then they're able to encode a size and orientation, which is absolutely, I mean, when I say stable, we're talking incredibly stable, 13.8 billion years stable at 190 degrees and like forever at room temperature. So it's very cool. Basically, so it's laser writing a blank quartz disk, and that will then, and it's 360 terabytes per little disk and last forever. So again, this is, you know, engineering paper, really cool technology. It'll be some time, and maybe we'll never see the light of day. Maybe something will eclipse it, but wow, very cool. And absolutely archival. Two pieces of errata. Last week, I kept saying text-to-speech, text-to-speech, text-to-speech when we were talking about the Amazon Echo. And that's, of course, the reverse direction of what I meant. Text-to-speech is text in, speech out. I was talking about speech recognition and the various technologies and you know, like does the Echo listen and send back to, you know, is it phoning the, is it sending it all back to the mothership, or is it doing local recognition?
Yeah, I should have noticed that too. Speech to text, obviously.
I just just wanted, exactly. And then a Twitterer, Danger Dad is his handle. He just corrected me. He said I was referring to 80 billion degrees of the German stellarator.
I noted that.
Yeah. No, I meant million.
I thought that was very high.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, a million, a billion, when you get that hot.
You know. Oh, and I also said it was sevenfold symmetry because it's got a seven in the name. And so that tripped me up. I knew that it was fivefold symmetry, so I also wanted to fix that because I had said sevenfold symmetry. Some real quick updates just on the because our listeners are demonstrating a real interest on the ZOEEG headband. Last week when we last spoke, there have been three auctions for 100, then 355, then 460. Totaling 915 that URT outlet seller or reseller had sold. And I just refreshed the page. They have now sold. They created a new auction. I think it was either they had just created it when – I think they had just created it shortly after we started talking 1 week ago. That auction has now sold 1,208 of the devices.
They got to be running out at some point.
They privately told me they had about 1,600. They had finally gotten around to counting them because they figured, you know, we better count these. We may actually sell these in our lifetime. So they've got a few hundred left at this point. And I'm really glad that because what I'm seeing is the rate of sales is tapering down. They'll still have a couple hundred probably for stragglers of the podcast who like, oh, my God, I want one. But what it means is that pretty much everyone who is listening to the podcast and thinks this would be cool has been able to buy, has been able to get one because it is neat. It's only $40 for the whole system. You need an Android device. But, you know, it would have really annoyed me if they only had 100, yet, you know, that would have never satisfied, obviously, now, because it's been like, I don't know, 2,500 or so have been sold to our listeners. But and it is slowing down. So it looks like people who want them have them. And that's all I could ask for.
The power of the security now.
And finally,
advertisers, listen up. Next time, pay. Oh, sorry.
From Beirut, Lebanon. Or is it Beirut? Is
Beirut.
It? This time I got Beirut. It. Beirut, Lebanon. And this individual, thank you, asked me to withhold his name because I could never have pronounced it. His last name took up about half the line, And so thank you. But he is a I'm not sure he's a SpinRite user, but he was wondering, the subject was files gone from hard disk. And he wrote, "Hello, Steve. I have a two-year-old desktop that suddenly started causing problems. For example, it would show the recover the Windows option during boot sometimes, and sometimes it would just boot normal. After a couple of times, the recovery options started popping up every time, and the recovery options were of no use. I took the hard disk off the desktop and connected to my laptop using a SATA USB extension to get the data out of it. At this point, to my surprise, some data were present and some others were not, even though I was sure the data was there and I have not deleted them. Is this even possible? I mean, do bad sectors cause data to just disappear? I ran a recovery software, but it sounds like not SpinRite, to check if the files were deleted, and it found nothing. What would possibly have gone wrong? How would SpinRite help in such a scenario? Thank God I had a very recent backup and just lost 3 days of work." And he says, "In case you're going to talk about this on SN, I would appreciate if you do not disclose my name. Thanks a lot. Regards." And so this is interesting, because it's a little different than what we've talked about, although I have mentioned it. And the answer is, if there is problem in the file system metadata, that is the directory structure, there any file system has files that themselves contain the data that the file system stores, but there is always management information. Back in the day of DOS, we talked about the FAT, the file allocation table, which showed which clusters had been allocated, and it was by scanning that the system could quickly tell how much space was available remaining on the disk by how many clusters had not been allocated and had zero bits set in the FAT. But all file systems have some means of managing the files. And it's not the file data, that makes it the metadata, or commonly called the directory structure. The symptoms absolutely sound like there was a flaky metadata sector. And so it's very much, you know, our listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with how a file system can be viewed as a tree, you know, a hierarchy of folders, which are branches that contain folders that contain folders that contain folders. And so this creates a branching structure. So it might be that a sector contains pointers to other folders in the tree or pointers to files. And if that sector cannot be read, then the files that it points to or the folders and everything else downstream disappears. And so it sounds like this drive was sort of on the edge. Sometimes it could get read and then Windows would boot. Sometimes stuff was missing, and it was missing because the metadata that time wouldn't read. It is a classic case of SpinRite being able to recover. Sounds like he had a backup that was only 3 days old. He didn't need it. But for what it's worth, he could have used SpinRite. I mean, this is like exactly. And it even sounds like it wasn't that far gone. It wasn't the typical hard crash where everything is just gone now and nothing but SpinRite will bring it back. It sounds like it was just getting to the point where it wouldn't have been, you know, it was no longer reliable. SpinRite probably could have sucked it back to life in no time. So for what it's worth, if you find yourself in that situation and you don't have a recent backup and you do have a copy of SpinRite around, it'll probably fix it for you.
You don't have a lot of experience probably with Linux or Mac files. Well, you do with a Mac. Do you have a favorite file system? Is it NTFS? Is it XFAT? Is it HFS? Do you have an opinion?
I don't. I don't have a useful, mature opinion. One of the things that SpinRite 7...
I'll take a childish opinion. That's okay.
One of the things that SpinRite 7 will do is have knowledge of all of the different file systems. I'm going to take SpinRite from physical data recovery to true file system recovery. That's the plan. And, you know, I forgot to mention last week when I talked about changing the BIOS in order to get SpinRite 6 to work. I think I scared people off, and I forgot to mention that anybody who has SpinRite, all SpinRite owners, will get 6.1 at no charge. So I did want to make sure everyone understood that I consider that my obligation. Everyone says, Steve, you know, that's very generous, but many people I know are buying SpinRite to support me and GRC and the podcast in, like, under the assumption that 6.1 is going to come and it's gonna, and there's a future there. So I wanted to make sure people understood that. I'm happy to do that. I'm very excited about 6.1. And once Squirrel is behind me, that's what I'm back to.
Good. We're waiting with bated breath, Mr. G, as you know. What is this little teacup you've got? How many shots of caffeine can you get in that thing?
No, I have one of these. This was when I was married. This was the fancy
That's the China
setting.
Yeah, yeah.
And Juliet made off with all of the rest. only because this one just sort of was a stray. And I found it years later, and I thought, well, fine. I'm going to just drink
memory
from the good China.
A little memory. Yeah. I have some, being on my third wife, I have some old wedding gifts lying around. Lisa's put most of them in the garage, though.
But I do like it because I draw from the tank. You know, I have
what
the
is
big
that?
The
tea?
Big silk.
Oh,
tank.
I see. So you are using coffee, but from your Contigo.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Because the whatever it was, the Nirvana thermal thermos is still in shipment from China.
The temp
somewhere.
Perfect.
The temp perfect. Mug. The temp imperfect.
Good Lord. So yeah. I do sometime I want to, and I'm sure you'll do this work. It is possible to make a UEFI bootable key, like a USB key, because I get them all the time. And I'm really curious what would be involved in that. I guess you'd have two partitions, one that would have a certificate of some kind in there to valid. I'm not sure what would be involved for a secure boot.
I have not gone there yet, but
because I'd like to be able to make, you know, some secure boot compatible keys. I don't want to have to turn off secure boot.
I'm trying to think of the name. I think it's called ReUFI, R-E-U-F-I. I have something on my Mac that allows me to dual boot, and it's the way I was able to verify that SpinRite could run on the Mac only if it fixed the keyboard. And so I actually have a version of SpinRite that does run on the Mac because Mac uses a USB-like keyboard. But I think it's called REUFI.
I'm sure it's not. That would be Rufi, and probably not the best acronym ever.
Could it be Redos, REDOS? Check that. Is your machine
back
up?
I got my machine working. By the way, unplugging a variety of USB devices. Sometimes a device hanging off your USB can hang up something. I don't see REUFI. Rufi. But
I don't have my
somebody
my
called
my
the back. Radio show with a great new boot manager, which I've of course immediately forgotten. Was that from the caller? REUFI? Maybe I need a dash. What was the name of the boot manager he called about? But anyway, it sounded like a much better boot manager, and it did handle UEFI. That secure boot's a challenge.
Yes, it is. Yep.
Let me see if I can find it here. Rufus. Is
Rufus, that it? That's it.
Rufus. Hello, Rufus.
Yes. It's very capable. It may do everything I haven't looked at it for a while,
great.
But it just
bootable drives the easy way. Oh, this looks good.
Yeah, it made short order of my need to dual boot my Mac so that I was able to have bought DOS boot and run SpinRite in one partition and then the Mac in the other.
And they do, on the front page, they have the example of making a Tails bootable USB key, which is the primary use I'd have for this. Yeah. Okay. Don't know if it handles UEFI, but Rufus. Rufus. Let us take... Oh, then there's Refit. Refit.sourceforge.net.
Oh, Refit. That was the one.
Refit.
Yes, that's the one.
Okay.
Although that may be different.
I don't know.
Oh, and that's an EFI boot menu, it says.
EFI boot menu. There you go. I think this is the one. This is the one. Yeah, REFI it kind of idea.
Yep.
Let's take
Much
a break.
Much better than Rufus.
Much okay. better than Rufus. No, Rufus is fine too. But better than Rufy. Refit. Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks. Ladies and gentlemen, if you of the jury, if you are in a freelance mode, you know that as we get to the end of the month, it's the worst time of the month, isn't it? You got to do all those invoices. And you don't do the invoices. I got one thing I know for sure, you don't get paid. I was in that boat, didn't want to do it, hated doing it, put it off, often didn't invoice companies for months at a time. They don't like that. And I can guarantee you, you will not get paid until you invoice them. So then Amber MacArthur was actually when I was going up to Canada to do a call for help with you, Steve, and Amber. Told me about FreshBooks. Nice little Toronto startup. She said they're great. They let you do online invoices, email invoices. They will keep track of all this stuff for you. They make it easy for your clients to pay. And that was 10 years ago, 5 million users ago. FreshBooks is just awesome. The super simple cloud accounting software giving thousands of businesses like yours the tools they need to save time billing and get paid faster. Your invoices look great, but they've got a button on it right there the client can click saying, pay him, pay Leo. And you know, clients, it turns out, don't like paying invoices. Not because they don't want to give you the money, just because like, it's the same pain in the butt that making the invoices is. So make it easy for them. It'll make it faster to get paid. They just announced their new card reader. This is great for anybody who does services in home. Let's say you're a custom AVI install. You know, you go in and you build the beautiful home theater thing. You can use the FreshBooks iPhone app. You can do an estimate. Show your client the estimate, have it emailed to them, but also show them on the phone, get their approval, do the work, show them the invoice. Then you put the card reader in, they swipe it, or they dip the chip, or they swipe the stripe, and then you're paid. Wow! If you bill by hours, it has a trackable hours feature in the app. If you do receipts and expenses, I did, instead of a shoebox, you know, that you pull out every on the 31st of every month, You got it all. You take pictures of the receipts, and you got it all on the phone, and it automatically goes right into the invoice. I can go on and on. I want you to try it. 30 days free at FreshBooks.com/security now. FreshBooks.com/security now. And when you're doing the free trial and they ask you, well, where did you hear about this? Just in right there, you just type security now, if you would. FreshBooks.com/security now. And we thank them for supporting us. And Steve, in our efforts. Hey, there he is, Steve Arino. Hey, ho, Steve Arino.
So, my last security topic for the week
is another
side channel attack, which is a little spooky, just because these guys understand the fun of some drama, and they set up a presentation, which is just wonderful. The show notes have the two pictures showing their setup. The first picture is on one side of a wall where they've got – they just sort of jig this thing together. So they've got a laboratory two-channel power supply that is running an SDR, a software-defined radio, providing power for that. And that's hooked to an antenna device. And the output of the software-defined radio then goes to a laptop, which is doing frequency spectral analysis of the information it's receiving. On the other side of the wall sits a laptop. It looks like a Lenovo with some version of Windows, just sort of sitting there doing nothing. what these guys have achieved is in a matter of minutes extracting the Diffie-Hellman elliptic curve keys from that laptop.
No.
Yeah.
Say it ain't so.
Yeah. So they say in their write-up, we show that the secret decryption keys can be extracted from PCs running the ECDH, that's the elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, encryption algorithm. Using the electromagnetic emanations generated during the decryption process. By measuring the target's electromagnetic emanations, the attack extracts the secret decryption key within seconds from a target located in an adjacent room through a wall. Then they say ECDH, elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, is a standard public key encryption algorithm used in OpenPGP. And they give the RFC and the NIST specs. They write, we attacked the ECDH implementation of GNU-PG's libgcrypt 1.6.3, the latest version at the time the paper was written. The attack asks for decryption of a single, carefully chosen ciphertext iterated a few dozen times. I should mention that the few dozen iterations is more for the sake of improving the signal-to-noise ratio than like they needed to actually see it multiple times. So my point is that that's the kind of thing that an evolution of this attack could reduce or minimize, if they really, probably if they just spent a lot more time. Instead, it was just easier for them to iterate the same thing in order to get multiple samples of the machine doing the decryption, and then sort of sum them together or average them together in order to separate more of the signal from the noise. And then they use time frequency signal analysis techniques to extract from the electromagnetic leakage emitted by the target laptop during the execution of the ECDH decryption. So what this comes down to, and we've talked about this in other contexts before, is that the particular implementation, this is not a problem with the laptop. They're all going to leak unless they're like tempest hardened, and those are not ones that we have. They're going to leak, and it's not a problem with the math of elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, which is good. It's a problem with the implementation, and it's one of the reasons that, for example, for Squirrel, I chose Dan Bernstein's library because Dan is a stickler. If he's anything, he's a stickler for detail. And the crypto from that I chose for Squirrel has no execution paths based on secret material. That's the key. The mistake is it's easier to write crypto where the key affects the instruction sequence that the computer follows. If you do that, this is what happens. Because the instruction sequence will result in subtle variations of emitted radiation or power consumption or, even maybe some inaudible sound. And that's the problem, is that something that is supposed to be secret has that, and that's why we call it a side channel. It's not an attack on the encryption channel. It's an attack on a side effect of decrypting the information, a side channel attack. And so in their own little Q&A, I just grabbed two out of the out of more, Q1 and Q4. The first question was, how vulnerable are GNU-PG and other applications that use libgcrypt now? So they say, we've disclosed our attack to the GNU-PG developers and worked with the developers to implement countermeasures. GNU-PG's libgcrypt 1.6.5 containing these countermeasures and they must have meant is resistant to the extraction attack described here was released concurrently with the public posting of these results, although that's recent. So the vulnerable one was 1.6.3. 1.6.5 is current. So the fix exists, the patches exists. If this is a concern, you'll want to update GNU-PG as soon as they publish code that has this fixed. And then they wrote specifically, libgcrypt 1.6.5 completely changed their implementation of the elliptic point curve multiplication using the double and always add algorithm. This is slower than the previous implementation, but more resistant to side channel attacks since the sequence of high level arithmetic operations does not depend on the secret key. And that's what you need. This is going to end up becoming clearly standard practice moving forward, although it's obviously not yet going to be standard practice for, you know, one of the ways we evaluate the security of ciphers is not just bit banging and, you know, how wide is the block size and how many iterations does it go through? And, you know, and if we reduce the iteration strength, is there a lower iteration weakness that we can find, blah, 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 blah. It's going to end up as important is going to be, is this thing algorithm, is the algorithm used to implement the math absolutely secret key neutral, meaning that no secret bits are involved in changing what the processor does. And as an example, it may slow it down. You know, everyone's always wanting this stuff to be as fast as possible. But that comes at a cost of some leakage. Now, there may certainly be scenarios where it's not a problem. You know, if you're using some appliance in a sub at the bottom of the ocean and you're around people you trust, then there's nowhere for it to leak to. But there are certainly instances where you'd like to know that you've got a side channel attack proof solution. And then, oh, I love this one. Q4 was, what if I can't get physically close enough to the target computer? So they respond for RSA and LGAML. Those are two previous side channel attacks that they had demonstrated, though not yet for ECDH. Similar attacks have been demonstrated from large distances. And get this. One was what they called, and we talked about this at the time, laptop chassis potential measured from measured from the far end of virtually any shielded cable connected to the laptop, such as an Ethernet, a USB, an HDMI, or a VGA, can be used for key extraction, as we demonstrated in a paper presented at CHES 14. So 2 years ago, that's when we talked about this, if you had any shielded wire hooked to a machine, the shield carried this noise. There's just no way for it not to. So no matter how long the cable was, hooking to that shield at the other end, they were able to extract the key from RSA and LGAML, not yet from ECDH. And then they also presented at Crypto 14 using acoustic emanations measured via a microphone, they write, can also be used to extract keys from a range of several meters as we showed in a paper presented at Crypto 14. So it is, I think it's clear that from what we're seeing, this is no longer just theoretical. It's, you know, we've talked about similar attacks where software running in the same virtual machine, like sharing a host with another virtual machine, can actually feel what the other virtual machine is doing and extract keys just by being co-resident in the same hardware, even if there's no actual contact between the two. I think moving forward, we're going to end up with this whole idea of this being secret key neutral as another important requirement and attribute of encryption technology. And that's our podcast.
Nice. Your timing is impeccable, Mr. G. I'm sorry about your site. Is it still down?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll be dealing with it for the next, we don't know how long.
Well, I mean, I don't know to what extent you want to pursue this. We could talk to, I'll send a note to John Graham Cumming over at, as I mentioned, at Cloudflare. You know, Squarespace, you could set up a temporary Squarespace site where you could do e-commerce if you wanted to continue to sell SpinRite.
Understand that all of this takes huge amounts of cycles. I mean, it's just me.
Yeah, I know.
And,
you know what?
And I mean,
the thing is, they'll move on, I presume. And they usually do. They'll move on. The question is if they're aiming at you intentionally or if it's just you happen to be a, you know, convenient target or, you know, what's going on.
And that's, see, it's so tempting to try to gain some insight.
Yeah.
And when the attacks lasted an hour and a half, 30 minutes, and they came and went, I thought, okay, you know, it's a Saturday afternoon. Somebody's, you know, testing an attack tool.
Well, a kid was home from school and.
And then on, I guess it was the next day on the 14th, on Valentine's Day, 13 gigabits of attack. So, and the other attacks were large also. I just wasn't seeing them. So, anyway, I'll be working with Level 3, and I'll let my Twitter followers know what I know, and I hope that I am allowed to be back on the internet because I like to be on the internet.
Yeah. It's a new form of vandalism, kiddies. And I do mean kiddies. I can't really send you to his site, but normally it's at grc.com. That's where you'll find SpinRite and all that great stuff when it comes back. It'll be back in a couple of days, I'm sure. You can also follow Steve, and you should now, on Twitter, at sggrc, because he'll let you know when the site is back and whatever he learns. And, of course, he's always tweeting and responding good questions. Might have questions next week if the site comes back, grc.com/feedback. If not, well, I'm sure Steve has plenty of other things he could talk about. And let's see, what else? We do have the podcast. You can at least get that. And you know what? If you email us the show notes, we'll make sure that that's on the show note page on twit.tv/SN.
I'll do that. Elaine has tweeted and said that she would she would get the audio from you rather than me recompressing it for her as I normally do.
Okay.
So she's aware of what's going on, too.
It'll go up in a little bit. Twit.tv/SN. Of course, you can subscribe everywhere. Thing is, you can't kill this podcast because it's multi-homed. You'd have to have more than 13 gigabits. You'd have to have more than that because it's everywhere. And
although there is no podcast without SpinRite, so we do need SpinRite.
Yeah, we'll have to figure something out on that one. grc.com. We'll be back. I promise you. One way or t'other. I'm sure you're going to be hearing from some fans who want to help out. Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next week on Security Now.
Thanks, Leo.
Bye-bye. Security Now.